The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Joe Scarborough, the host of Morning Joe, is our guest today on the Mike Lupica Podcast. But first, this from FanDuel. FanDuel is fantasy football for everyday fans. There are new contests starting every week, so you won't have any more busted seasons. All you have to do is pick a contest, choose your team, and watch the score in real time. You have to try FanDuel now and get up to $50 in free entries. Go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and use my promo code Lupica. That's FanDuel.com, promo code Lupica, void where prohibited. We are joined today on the Mike Lupica Podcast by my friend Joe Scarborough. He is the host of the wildly popular Morning Joe on MSNBC. I believe it is a decade now. He is a former Republican congressman from the state of Florida. He is a proud son of the Alabama Crimson Tide, so he's very happy with the way the college football season started. In full disclosure, I now appear usually once a week on Morning Joe, and my son was once a senior producer there, but he's now left. And I told Joe that if you were a general manager in sports and you traded Alex Lupica for me, you'd get fired for a trade that.
Yeah, but no doubt about it. We love having you on the show. We just need to get you on there a lot more.
Well, that's fine with me. We are having this conversation the day after Hillary Clinton announced to everybody that she has pneumonia. And Joe, let's start there, because that may be the only thing that could have taken a couple of news cycles away from the speech she gave on Friday night and about the deplorables. It almost sounds like a movie or a new series. What was your first reaction when you read those comments?
Well, I actually, first reaction was, oh, that wasn't too smart. About 10 seconds later, I thought, oh, wait a second. She's doing this on purpose, because she's, by talking about the deplorables, talking about the 50%, highlighting the racism, the sexism, the xenophobia, the nativism, what she was doing was it actually was ripping a page out of Trump's playbook, where you say something controversial, it dominates the news cycle, and then everybody's talking on what you want to talk about. So if Trump, after Paris, goes overboard and says, I don't know, Barack Obama is responsible for the Paris killings because he's such a weak president, everybody could be offended, but they're talking. You know, the debate is on Trump's terrain, post-Paris, post-Brussels, post-Orlando. It's the same thing here, where I loved how Hillary Clinton said, okay, I'm going to grossly generalize. And then she grossly generalized about the faction of racists that support Donald Trump. And then in her apology, she basically said, I regret making gross generalizations about the deplorables, but then went on to basically say the same thing. She doubled down. And so had she not fanned, we would have had night after night of debates over whether Trump supporters and whether Trump himself is xenophobic, whether he's racist. And, you know, it played out this morning on our show, where, of course, the first thing you do is you say, well, let's look at polls of Trump supporters and go back. And, of course, when we did that this morning on the show, we saw that, you know, 60% or 80% of Trump supporters in South Carolina during the primary supported the Muslim ban. Something like 45% support banning Islam. Pretty shocking numbers.
In light of this news and what happened at the 9/11 ceremonies yesterday, does her health now, which was something spoken about in this vague sort of way by some of the headbangers on the Trump side,
right,
does this now more than ever become a front and center issue of this campaign?
I don't think so. I mean, if she has another incident, it does. But at this point, if she gets on a debate stage and out debates Trump, then nobody's going to be talking about this in a couple of weeks. If Trump debates her. You know, likewise, they're not going to be talking about this. I just don't think that this is going to hurt her anywhere near the email controversy or the foundation controversy did, or the FBI report. I think this is going to be something that people will chatter about for a day or two and then just let it go.
Is it impossible to take a step back? I'm talking to Joe Scarborough. Joe, is it impossible to take a step back and wonder what this campaign would look like if former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had never decided to use a private email server?
Yeah. It really is unbelievable how this one issue has so dominated news coverage since that disastrous UN press conference. And it underlines all of the problems that both of the Clintons have had. If you go back to that press conference, you could say she dissembled, she did this, she just lied, outright lied about the email. And so many of her supporters say it wasn't a big deal. Okay, well, if it's not a big deal, say it's not a big deal. Hey, listen, here's the deal. I got an email server. Maybe I shouldn't have done it, but I went ahead and got one because Republicans have been waging holy war against me for 30, 35 years. They've tried to destroy my marriage. They've tried to destroy my husband. They've tried to destroy my daughter. They tried to destroy my family. So I just wanted to do something that would have isolated us a bit more. People would have understood that. And if she had talked about that a year ago and apologized, then I think everybody would have moved on a lot faster. It's just like this problem when she passed out or started to faint. They should have just gone ahead and said right out, hey, you know, she's been battling walking pneumonia or whatever, you know, pneumonia for the past 4 or 5 days, and there wouldn't have been as much speculation in the press.
We're talking to Joe Scarborough, who has spent so much of his adult life in and around and in the barrel on politics. Joe, I use this reference all the time, and I look back at David Letterman when he was being blackmailed about a relationship with a woman who worked on his show. He showed the whole world how you get in front of your own story. And he went on his own show that night, and he discussed it to the point where people thought he was kidding at first. But he got out ahead of it. And what's been amazing to me about Hillary Clinton is she's been chasing her own story on these emails from the start.
She has. And it's been painful. And there's just a constant drip, drip, drip of news stories that seem to keep coming out every day. I don't watch Bill O'Reilly's show, but one night I was flipping in between CNN and MSNBC and I forget the other network, and I went past Fox and Charles Krauthammer was there, and I stopped and listened to what Krauthammer had to say. He was talking about Hillary Clinton, and he said, I've never seen anything like it in my life. This woman cannot get in front of her own story. Yep. She can't talk about policy because every single day she's having to answer a question about emails or answer a question about the foundation. Now she's going to have to answer questions about her health. And, Mike, I mean, you followed a lot of campaigns through the years, as have I. This campaign, have you ever seen a campaign more devoid of policy? Of policy, because you've got one candidate that doesn't know policy enough to debate it, yeah, and another that can never turn the topic to what her health care plan will be or what her national defense posture will be in the world or what she'll do for taxes, regulations, et cetera, because there's always a different story every day that she's having to respond to that doesn't involve policy but involves personal crises that she and her husband have put themselves through.
And she is married to, and I place no value judgment on Bill Clinton's character or his legacy or Lewinsky or anything else. She is married to one of the most gifted politicians we may ever see. And none of that has rubbed off, Joe, none of that has rubbed off on her as a candidate.
She is as bad of a politician as her husband is good. And I think it's actually disarming when she admits that. Mika and I were interviewing her in South Carolina back in February, and Mika was pushing her on why she had been so clumsy in handling the email matter. And she said, listen, I'm just not a good politician. You know, my husband got all of those talents. I don't have those talents. I'm just hard worker. I really do think her approach should be what George H.W. Bush's approach was. Remember the 88 convention, Peggy Noonan just wrote an incredible speech where Bush basically said he wasn't articulate, said he was a quiet man, but he listens when the quiet people speak. And he actually did a great job embracing his weakness. I think Hillary Clinton would do much better to just say, listen, I'm not a good politician. I'm not a natural politician. I'm not going to be able to charm you with the way I talk. I'm not going to be able to change your mind. Chances are good with reading a speech from a teleprompter. That's not what I do. Talk to my colleagues in the Senate, including my Republican colleagues in the Senate, and they will tell you what I do is I work, I study, I read up, I ask questions, I tirelessly pursue what I consider to be the truth, and I work to represent my people. That's what I do. I'm not great at giving speeches. I'm not great at putting together 30-second commercials. I'm just not the politician my husband is, but I will work harder than anybody. That actually would be turning a negative into a positive. As it is now, I think just the take on her is she's just a bad politician, which actually, you work it the right way in 2016, that could be very favorable.
Talking to Joe Scarborough, are you somewhat stunned by the way she has squandered the momentum that she came out of her own convention with?
Well, I am, but, you know, it's, again, so much of it's out of her control. In fact, the campaign itself is nervous going into the fall. What's the October surprise going to be? What's WikiLeaks going to throw on her? We really have a race that may be decided by what the Russians decide to let the rest of us read. And so I don't know what else Hillary Clinton can do, again, because she's just being held captive.
Talking to Joe Scarborough, who from the start of the Trump campaign, and even as you were being accused of being the head of the Trump team's pep squad, okay?
Right.
All you were saying, I mean, I was there week after week, and I watched the thing play out. To me, what you were saying was, don't dismiss this guy. This guy's going to be
the same thing. I mean, you know, we know Trump, and we've known Trump for a long time, and you were saying the same thing, which is, don't dismiss him. This guy could win the Republican nomination. And people, you know, it's kind of like a weatherman taking the blame for predicting a hurricane was coming and predicting it right. Yeah. Well, we predicted the hurricane was coming, and we got it right, and almost everybody else got it wrong. But, you know, from the very beginning, I said I was going to be supporting Jeb, and when Jeb got out, I said I was going to be supporting Kasich. And now I don't know. I may have to end up writing in Mike Lupica on that top line.
Nah, if nominated, I will not serve. Hey, I'm using this word extremely loosely, the relationship between Trump and Scarborough go off the rails? Is there a moment, or it's like a lot of guys I've covered in sports, Joe. It's like a lot of guys I've covered in sports. They say, well, when did you two stop getting along? And I say, I think the first time I ever wrote anything negative about him.
Well, yeah, you know, Meek and I were saying on the air he needed to apologize for the Mexican comment. He needed to apologize for the McCain comment. He said on the air it wasn't smart taking on Fox News. You should apologize for the Megyn Kelly comments. And we continued it. I will tell you where things really went bad. Bad for us all was after the proposed Muslim ban. I was horrified by it, and even said, and gosh, this was 10 months ago. That's why there have been some articles after I wrote this little parody song about him. He was like, the relationship went bad in March, April. No, I like 10, 11 months ago, after he proposed a Muslim ban, I said on the air, I said, is this what Germany looked like in 1933? This is horrific. It's offensive. And that was really the beginning of the end of him believing that we were best buds. And it was, you know, what's so funny about Donald is he thinks that because he's on your show and agrees to be on your show that you're going to be nice to him, and that somehow, you know, and that if you predict that he's going to win, that you're on his side. And I probably told the guy a dozen times and told his relatives a dozen times, hey, just because I'm predicting Donald is going to win the Republican nomination doesn't mean that I'm on his side. And I had to re-remind him of that when we started, Meek and I started whacking him hard after just, you know, the Muslim ban and the Mexican judge from Indiana and that entire routine. That's when it really turned ugly between us. But I said, you know, just like it wasn't personal when I was saying Donald is going to win the Republican nomination, it's not personal now that we're trashing him, saying he's not going to win the general election. I say, you know, what am I supposed to do when a guy completes four, you know, passes in a row and drives a team down the field and, you know, gets them in field goal range in like 45 seconds in the first half? I'm going to say he did a great job. If he throws four interceptions at the beginning of the second half, I'm going to say they may have to consider benching him. It's just not personal with us. With Mika and me, we just say it the way we see it, and that's why NBC pays us.
But he has made it occasionally personal on his side.
Oh, man, yeah.
Particularly against Mika.
Against Mika. And against both of us. But, you know, he's a bully, so he didn't, you know, he's focused mainly on Mika because I punched him back pretty aggressively. But, yeah, no, it's been very, very personal. I guess it's sort of sad that neither Mika nor I are surprised by it, and we don't really even take it personally because we've known Donald for a decade, and that's just unfortunately Donald being Donald.
More with Joe Scarborough after this. Have you ever wanted to own a made-to-measure suit that's one of a kind and uniquely yours? Thanks to Indochino, that is now possible and affordable. Indochino is reinventing men's fashion, and made-to-measure suits are the best kind you will ever own. So suit up. They allow you to customize the details you want from lining, lapels, and personal monogram. You can't go wrong with the well-crafted 100% merino wool suit. You'll look good and you'll feel good. This week, my listeners can get any premium suit for just $389 at Indochino.com when entering Lupica at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. Plus, shipping is free and your satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. That's Indochino.com, promo code Lupica for any premium suit for just $389 and free shipping. Get ready to look like $1 million. But you have to be amused. I mean, anybody who, and this isn't even inside baseball, because he has used Twitter as such a primary weapon and of his campaign. He once told me that Twitter was the New York Times without the losses. So,
right.
But you have to be amused at how many times where he begins to insult you by saying, don't watch low-rated Morning Joe, except he's clearly passionately watching it because he's responding to it almost point by point.
He says he's never going to watch, and then he sits and tweets and responds to everything he sees on there. And he makes a mistake of saying we're lowly rated at the time where we're getting our highest ratings ever. And we always, after he says that, we always, you know, we'll tweet back and thank him for, we said it's because of obsessive viewers like you that we're having our best ratings ever. Now it's hilarious, and you know, every time he tweets something out about us, we all have a good laugh and then go on with our day. It's funny, after one particularly nasty tweet about Mika and me, all day people were texting, "Are you okay? You okay?" I'm like, "Yeah. Why? What happened? Did the Red Sox lose?" No, Trump. We just don't care. By the way, how about the Red Sox, huh?
The Red Sox
on a run.
I was talking to John Heilman after Morning Joe today, and who is also a Red Sox fan, and I was saying that in an odd way, when you look at their team, I think they have enough starting pitching. They can clearly mash the ball, Koji Uehara, who was the closer on the last time they won the World Series, as an eighth inning guy, may turn out to be the most crucial figure, at least of the last 20 games of the regular season, because they have blown so many games this year in the seventh and eighth innings.
Yeah. No, I think so. I mean, we talked about this before. Without with good relief pitching, they're cruising at this point. We'll see what happens. It's exciting. I'm getting a little nervous about the Yankees, a team that was supposed to have their first losing season in 20-30 years. The Yankees finally lost yesterday, but they're coming on pretty strong as well.
And I'll tell you something else. You have to give their manager some credit for that, because even after they made all those trades at the trade deadline, Girardi was consistent in saying, no, we still have a good team. We still can be in this. And who would have ever thought a month and a half ago that we would be looking at a big September Yankee-Red Sox series at Fenway Park? But, Joe, that's exactly what we're going to get next weekend.
Boy, how exciting is that? It's going to be great. I'm hoping that the Sox get a big enough lead that we don't have to sweat it out like we usually have to sweat out September series between the Sox and the Yankees. I do not want to add 2016 to 75, 78, 86, and 2003.
Joe Scarborough and I were talking the other day, and he was tracing how he loved the Braves growing up, and then he became a Red Sox fan. But now, if you watch his show, you know this, but you have to explain to me how your passion for soccer became such an integral part of your sports fan life.
Well, in 2006, my son got me watching the World Cup. He was a smart guy. He knew the only way to get me to watch soccer was to fill out a bracket, and we probably put $10 on it, and he and all of his friends did. And so I started watching, and I fell in love with the game pretty quickly. And at that point, it was 2006 was when Zidane beat Brazil in the semifinals of the World Cup, and then Joey and I had to decide which teams we were going to follow. He picked Chelsea, which I didn't understand. I told him that was a lot like cheering for Microsoft, and I chose Liverpool because I wanted a team from the north and also a team that had a shot of at least getting into the Champions League every year. But couldn't cheer for Man U because that would just, only front runners pick Man U at this point. So I've just watched it. There's a lot that I love about it. It is the ultimate team sport. You can have a team that has spent $100 million on a lot of different players, but you know, they've got to move together. There's just such a flow to it. It's 11 people all working together and moving together, and you see the flow together. And a lot of times you know a goal's coming, 10, 15 seconds before it happens based on what's happening downfield. So it's a lot of fun. A lot of people think I'm crazy, but I follow the Red Sox religiously. I follow Alabama football religiously, and I follow Liverpool soccer. And at this point, that's about all the bandwidth I have. I believe it or not, I do not spend. I think there's a sort of the Southern guy in me. I do not spend my Sundays in front of the TV watching NFL games like I did growing up. Now I'm crazy about college football, especially the SEC, but just not NFL games.
And your love of music, a lifelong thing, because that as your life goes on, you play more in public and seem to embrace it more. You had big fun a couple of weeks ago with your new hit song, Amnesty Dawn.
Amnesty Dawn, exactly.
When did you learn to play, for example, when did you learn to play the guitar?
Learned to play the guitar in my early teens, but, my mom was a master's of music, and whatever town we went into, she was actually the choir director and church organist for whatever Episcopal church was around. And so she started teaching me piano when I was five. And, of course, like every other boy that's ever taught taught piano when he's young. I rebelled nonstop. Finally, she gave up when I was 8 or 9 because she knew that, you know, she was competing against baseball and football and basketball and knew I wanted to be out playing sports all the time. And the second she finally gave up was the second I started going downstairs and, you know, going to the basement and practicing piano and sort of teaching myself how to play by ear, then taught myself how to play guitar, then bass, and then started writing songs and recording them, and been doing that now for better part of 3 decades, 4 decades.
Let me circle back to politics for a second, and let me ask you what sounds like a general question, but might not be. Does the rise of Trump and the chance that he might be the next president of the United States, does that say more about him, or does it say something profound about the electorate and the mood of the country right now?
I think it says something more profound about our political system, that that most Americans just think they're being given a horrific choice. I know we in the media are shocked and stunned and deeply saddened that Americans would consider voting for Donald Trump given all the things that he said. You know, there are a lot of people that I talk to, and one of the reasons why Hillary's deplorables comment really doesn't fit as tightly when she talks about 50% of his supporters is because I'd say at least 50% of Donald Trump supporters are simply voting for him because he's not Hillary Clinton. They, you know, what do they deplore? They deplore Hillary Clinton. They deplore, you know, 55% of Americans in an ABC poll said they thought she should have been indicted for her, that Comey should have indicted her. You look at the fact that she has had a terrible time just simply telling the truth on a host of issues. You can look at her past history. Whether it's Benghazi as Secretary of State, which gets a lot of people ginned up, or the fact that she, you know, made things up when she was First Lady about coming under fire in Bosnia, you know, the sort of things that she said back in the 1990s on a variety of issues when her husband was president. She's been in the public eye for 30, 35 years. She fought for universal health care back when it was a really radical idea, and she's got the scar tissue of somebody who's been in the public eye for 30, 35 years. And so you know, Trump was a celebrity TV host, like up until like a year and a half ago. So there are just a lot of Americans who have their reasons for voting against Hillary Clinton. And that explains, at least in the general election, why this race is still as close as it is. I must say, you really dig into the Electoral College and look at the polls. I don't know. We may wake up the morning after and say this thing was Hillary's all along. Because we showed a number of polls this morning.
Yeah, I saw.
You know, 2 points in Georgia, 2 points in New Hampshire, 2 points in Arizona, 2 points in Nevada, 2 points here, 2 points there, you know, 2 points in Florida. Well, those are all states Trump has to win if he has any shot at all of being the next president of the United States. He also has to win Pennsylvania. He's not going to win Pennsylvania. So maybe at the end of this, we'll all say that it was much ado about nothing, but for right now, it does kind of look like a toss-up, doesn't it?
A couple of weeks ago, I was on the show, and I'd written a column in which I talked to our friend James Carville, and I went back, and I told you this that day, I went back and looked, everybody remembers The Economy Stupid. That was the most famous line on the war room wall in 1992, but there were two other things on that wall, and it's ironic to think about them now. One was healthcare, Joe, That was a big talk, but the other one was change versus more of the same.
Right.
And James said the one thing that has scared him all along about this election is that Trump is the change guy in a change year. And this is a long way around for me to ask you, is it that he's a change candidate in a change year that people who support him are willing to overlook the routine amount of bullshit he says every day in what making it sound like what Bob Costas calls a post-factual world, because now, sometimes it seems like he's just making stuff up.
Yeah, he is. He is making things up in a post-factual world. I mean, that's what the internet. It's part of what the internet's brought us, is that everybody's been going to websites that reinforce all their pre-existing biases, all of their pre-existing beliefs, all their pre-existing conspiracy theories. And so you basically, you know, you can shop for the cable news channel that reinforces all your pre-existing prejudices. You can shop for the talk radio show that does the same thing. You can shop for whatever facts you want to find on the internet. And it is under that media environment that Trump is flourishing. His followers go where they want to go. I've got members of the family that constantly are sending me conspiracy theories over text and over email. And I have to constantly email back and let them know that, no, it's just not true. You know, it's kind of like the old Trilateral Commission and Council on Foreign Relations hubbub that people would always talk about as far as conspiracy theories go. But I think a big part of the reason that he's getting away with this is he is the change candidate. And by the way, if you are the change candidate, who do you want to run against in the primary? You want to run against a Bush. Who do you want to run against in the general election? You want to run against a Clinton. He's running against 30, 35 years of policies that most Americans consider to be failed.
How did we get to a point in this country where Trump can't say what you just said about Hillary Clinton without also saying she's a crooked liar?
I don't know. I'm really surprised the number of people that even college educated people that aren't deeply offended by that and don't understand that by supporting it, they're telling their children that that's okay. They're telling their grandchildren that that's okay. Of course, they would turn around and say to me, first of all, they'd say you're a traitor as a Republican for even saying that, but they'd also say, well, look at Hillary Clinton. She should be in jail because of the emails, or let's say that, you know, she killed four people in Benghazi, or, you know, it's all just so personal. And it's a real shame that it's so personal. I think a lot of that also just has to do with the fact that the quality of candidate has just collapsed over the past decade. You can even go back to, I left Congress 15 years ago in 2001. Even when I was there, You had people who were legislative giants in the House and in the Senate, people that both sides could respect. And even if you detested, as a conservative, Ted Kennedy, you knew he was a liberal lion, that he had been around for a long, long time, that he was a master of the Senate, every bit as much as LBJ was. Or if you were a Democrat, you might not like Alan Simpson, but Alan Simpson was a master of the United States Senate. I could go down the list of people that, you know, Senator Bob Kerry from Nebraska, a great Vietnam hero. I was just surrounded by him when I was in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, they just aren't there anymore. Politicians that don't fear what's going to be said in their Twitter feed, or don't fear what's going to be said on MSNBC or Fox News at night, that aren't afraid of nasty comments in the comment section on websites. I mean, if you are not tough enough to ignore your mentions on your Twitter feed, you're not tough enough to have a voting card. And unfortunately, I just don't think we have members of the House and the Senate that are tough enough to do that and stand up. Like, for instance, I mean, let's talk about something that's very close to home for you and me. After Newtown, after the slaughter of those children in Sandy Hook, 90% of Americans wanted tougher background checks. 90%. And you had people, you had senators, Republican senators in states where 90% of their voters supported enhanced background checks. You had Democratic senators like Heidi Heitkamp, where 94% of people in her state, which is a hunting state, wanted enhanced background checks, and they both sided with the Washington arm of the NRA instead of doing what the overwhelming majority of people in their state wanted them to do, because they were scared. They ran scared. And, you know, unfortunately, that happens too much in Washington now.
I particularly pay attention to what you say about guns, because you had bona fides, you know, with the NRA when you were a candidate. But,
well, I had 100% rating with the NRA, and, you know, there may be three people in the NRA that run the NRA in Washington, D.C. that don't like what I say, but I guarantee you 85-90% of NRA members agree with me. I know 85% agree with me that we need enhanced background checks, that we need to stop terrorists that are on the no-fly list from being able to get their hands on guns, that we need to make sure we have background checks so people can't walk into gun shows, so terrorists or domestic abusers can't walk into gun shows without having an adequate background check, or, you know, can't buy guns online without an adequate background check. This is just common sense that not only Republicans, 80-90% of Republicans support, but 80% of gun owners support. And how absolutely astounding is it that in my party, in my Republican Party, you can't name one Republican member of leadership in the House or the Senate that supports enhanced background checks to keep military-style weapons out of the hands of terrorists in the age of ISIS? How stunning is that, Mike?
No, it defies logic or common sense. And you know what else it defies, Joe? It defies humanity at the same time.
It really does. I tell you, especially after Newtown, I don't think I've ever been as disappointed and angry with Congress as I was then. So,
no, Joe,
it's been great talking to you. I really, really appreciate you having me on.
Let me ask
podcast.
You one more question. Let
oh,
me
sure.
ask you one more question, because anybody who does Morning Joe knows that it is a stupid amount of fun to do. Do you ever think, what do you think is the principal appeal of the show? Because every day, there are moments in that show where you're carrying on a conversation, not just with Mika, but five or six of the rest of us.
I think, you know, and I'd be really more curious to hear what you think works for it. But as for me, I just think that we get people on like you and Heilman and Halperin and Mika and Eddie Gloud and a lot of others, Gene Robinson, who they just don't play TV.
Father Barnacle.
Of course, Father Barnacle's at the top of the list. Willie Geist, top of the list. But we sit around the table and, you know, there are no scripts. There are no production notes to speak of that we have to follow. We just sit around the table and talk. And it is a free-willing conversation that can go any direction at any time. And I think that really works, because when people come up to me in airports or on the street or at baseball games or wherever, they come up and hug me and they go, oh, wait, you don't know who I am. And I said, no, but that's okay. Hug away. That's fine. And they say, you know, I feel like I know you, because it's like I have breakfast with you every morning. And I think, you know, I think that's the key to it. We don't play TV and people connect for that reason.
I'll see you in a couple of days. Thank you so much for doing this today.
All right, buddy. I really appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Joe Scarborough, the host of Morning Joe. And if you have followed this political season, and if you have followed it since Trump came down the escalator about 15 or 16 or 17 months ago, whatever it was, you have had the sense that the whole thing has flowed through that show. I tell you all the time, there couldn't have been a better day to have him on after what happened with Hillary. Please download our podcast. Please subscribe, because this is the caliber of guest that we get every week. I'll talk to you next week.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.